Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. May 9th is one of the most important dates on the calendar for Russians. It was on this day in 1945 fascism in Europe was finally crushed. In the West, this historical achievement has faded. Celebrating the end of this war is no longer a high priority. In fact, there has been a long, ongoing attempt to understate the role the Soviet Union played in defeating the Nazis. Crosstalking Victory Day in Europe, I'm joined by my guest Nikolai Petro in Washington. He's a professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. In Belgrade, we have Stephen Gajic. He is a research associate at the Belgrade Institute of European Studies. And in Germany, we cross to Konstantin von Hofmeister. He is the author of Esoteric Trumpism and Multipolarity, as well as founder and director of Multipolar Press. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Nikolai, let me go to you. I'm wearing the St. George ribbon. The city of Moscow is all decorated, cleaned up after this very long winter. And it is it's very festive, remembering the end of the Second World War in Russia. It is on May 9th. And it's very much part of everyday history here. No matter where you go, and I don't care if it's a large city or a town or even a village, you're going to see a memorial, a monument that commemorates the huge sacrifice that saved Europe from fascism. But that's not the case in Europe anymore. As I said in my introduction, is largely faded. Why is that?
Well, because European governments, to put it bluntly, see themselves as effectively allied with a government in Ukraine that, for want of a better term, is akin to fascist. It is a government that is extremely nationalist, that aims to establish an ethno-polity in Ukraine, a monoculture of Ukrainians for Ukrainians. And so, in that context, there's not much to be happy about regarding the outcome of World War II.
Stephen, to you as well, because one of the things, when I was in graduate school, my specialty was Eastern European and Russian studies. And if you look at the interwar years, particularly the 1930s, most Eastern European countries don't have a lot to be proud of. They were fascistic. Many of them were very aligned with Nazi Germany, admired the Nazis. That's a history that they don't like to remember. And so with the Soviet victory, it kind of cleans the slate. And then the Cold War put everything into deep freeze, to extend the metaphor here. And so when you're talking about the defeat of fascism, well, that is something that is more nuanced the more you look into it. Stephen.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at what was happening after the fall of the Berlin Wall, especially in Eastern European countries, you had this equation between all totalitarianisms,
right,
which in effect meant that they said that Stalin and Hitler are all the same, that communism and Nazism are basically the same thing. And a lot of these museums of totalitarianisms were erected everywhere. Almost in Eastern Europe. I mean, when I say everywhere, of course, it means where the pro-Nazi feeling was predominant, like the Baltic states, like Hungary, and some other places. And this culminated in 2008 with the so-called Prague Declaration,
yep,
which was a first major move in historical revisionism that is now in full swing. And now what we see is something really devastating. We've heard a German chancellor saying that Germany should have the strongest military by 2039. I don't think this was said by chance. It is 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War II. If I was French or Polish, I would be very concerned about it. As a Serb, I'm also very concerned about the southeast sector, as Hitler used to call us. And again, I think we might be in the military focus of Germany, and this is very dangerous. This did not happen by chance. It was quite clear back in 2014, so 12 years ago, that Europe is going down this path when George Friedman said it openly in Belgrade that the Americans, speaking about the Obama administration, the globalists, basically, that they want the Germans to convert their industry to military industry and to do what they're best in doing, which is sending their boys to the East. That's exactly what he said. I think that was a last call for alarm, but nothing really happened. And Europe was just continued sleepwalking towards a great war. And I think that they are preparing, that that Germany in particular is preparing for a great standoff with Russia, which is
Let's ask Constantine that. Constantine, how do you react to what Stephen just said there? Because, again, you know, this is a very important day where I live here, but it should also be a very important day for Germany as well, because, you know, remembering the past, learning from the past is very important. But now we have a German chancellor that's talking about remilitarization and openly talking about a future war with Russia. So what was the victory all about in 1945 if we have to go through it all over again?
Well, I completely agree with you. And apparently the German government hasn't really learned its lesson from history, because it's basically the same exact outlook that the government is displaying right now. I mean, in the past, like the Nazis during World War II, when they launched Operation Barbarossa on the Soviet Union, they claimed that they were going to liberate the Russians from the Bolshevik yoke. But of course, it was all a propaganda lie, because in reality, as everybody knows, I mean, Hitler had already outlined it in Mein Kampf. It was all about Lebensraum, meaning a living space. So the Germans wanted to colonize the Soviet Union. They wanted to exterminate a large part of the population and enslave the rest. I mean, this is well known. And it was really not only the Germans. It was like the entirety of Western Europe that was somehow involved in this massive army. I mean, you had the Waffen-SS, which was a volunteer army that was attached to the German military on the Eastern Front. And the Waffen-SS had about 1 million members, and less than half of them were Germans. Yep. I mean, more than 500,000, almost 600,000, were from other parts of Western Europe, including France, the Netherlands, and they even had a British one, a small one. The French SS division, Charlemagne, was especially prominent because apparently, like, some of the French SS soldiers were the last ones to defend Adolf Hitler in the bunker in Berlin when the Red Army was already in the streets. So the Western Europeans like to forget this part of the history.
Yeah, well, in my mind, that's the real revisionism here. That's the hiding away, creating blank spots for blemishes here. Let me go back to Nikolai in Washington, staying with the German question here. But for security reasons, it makes more sense that Germany and Russia should be strong allies. That would create stability in Europe. But that is verboten. That's verboten ideologically right now, and because of the presence of the very strong, important presence of the United States and NATO, even though they're having their unusually powerful spat. But that's what it's really all about, is to control the fate, the security fate of Europe. Nikolai.
So this is, you asked about whether a reconstitution of some sort of close relationship between Germany and Russia would be desirable?
Well, logically, that would be the case. Remember the phrase, keep the Americans in, the Germans down, and the right. Russians out.
Russians out, yeah. it would, but we have an unusually stubborn and, I think, ignorant in many ways of their own national interests, German elite in power now. And among them, the only redeemable groups that I can see are the BSW, Bündnissache Wagner, and the IFD have more or less, not, I would say, pro-Russian policies, but at least policies that question the current trajectory of war with Russia, that the current German leadership seems quite comfortable with. Of course, we have former German chancellors who have warned very strongly against this, particularly in the SPD, and including Gerhard Schröder, who is still alive and would be a voice of wisdom to listen to on this matter. But they are on the outs and ostracized, essentially, from having any political influence.
You know, kind of Stephen, it's very interesting to me that we've seen, state-sponsored Russophobia as a principle for the European Union to keep its cohesion and even Europe. But again, that is repeating the same mistake. And in the second part of the program, I want to talk about the security architecture, what went wrong in the 1930s, what went wrong after the Cold War, and what's going wrong now. Real quickly, before we go to the break.
Yeah, you already outlined it. We are on a trajectory, unfortunately, of war. And this is, I would say, an ideological preparation for the military industrialization that is to follow and that is already happening. In light of a perhaps future war in Europe, this thing happening in Ukraine might look just as a small flu. And I'm really concerned about this possibility.
Yeah, but Stephen, if I can interrupt you before I interrupt myself here, but militarization is not going to solve the European Union's problems. I think that is the fundamental thing to realize here. But they're oblivious to it because militarization will keep this political elite in power, or at least they think so. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Victory Day in Europe. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Victory Day in Europe. Okay, let's go back to Constantine. I mean, one of the reasons why I really like doing this program, because it makes us look at a very broad palette of history here, because the Second World War came about, and I'm giving my theory of the case here, is because of the lack of a very poor security structure in Europe in the wake of the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, which essentially put a tamper on German expression in the international system, at least for a while, and the Soviet Union was permanently exiled. And this is one of the reasons why we had this conflict, because the creation of these weak states in Eastern Europe were easy prey for a regime like the Nazis here. The Soviet Union solved this, at least for temporarily, came in this huge regime change, to use today's words, and we had a Cold War. And that was a superficial security arrangement that lasted for four decades. At the end of the Cold War, we have the same dilemma of a lack of a security architecture that included Russia, because the security architecture was designed without and against Russia. We're in the same boat. That's why remembering what happened in 1945 is really important, because we have a very unstable security architecture in Europe. We're repeating history here. Constantine.
Well, I completely agree. And I think it's just history, again, like I said earlier, history repeating itself, because Russia has never been fully accepted by Western Europeans as being part of the European family or part of European civilization. I think a lot of Russian leaders in the past have approached Western Europe wanting to be a part of a common civilization, but they've always been rejected. And I think, I mean, the Nazis in World War II was just a very extreme example when imperialism, Western imperialism, resurfaced, but not against peoples in the third world or the so-called third world, like India and Africa, as was the case with British imperialism, but against fellow Europeans when Western Europeans, especially the Germans, the Nazis, viewed a large part of the European family as somehow lesser, of lesser value and of lesser worth. And as we know, that the Nazis and Adolf Hitler were big fans of the British imperialists, and they tried to emulate what the British had done to India in the Soviet Union and in Russia. Basically, they wanted their own colonial empire, and they viewed the Slavic populations as colonial subjects, just like the British viewed the Indians as colonial subjects. And the British claimed they wanted to, bring civilization to the quote-unquote savages, and the Nazis claimed they wanted to liberate, Eastern Europe, or go on a crusade against Stalin. And a lot of Western Europeans, other nations, were very excited and wanted to participate in this crusade. And I think a lot of them were quite aware that it was not really a crusade against Bolshevism, but it was really a crusade, again, for Western imperialism, in this time in its Nazi incarnation. And today we see the parallels, because nothing has changed. Like, British imperialism in the past said that the British people should go to India and civilize the natives and bring the blessings of Western values. Today it's the same. You have the liberal establishment that say that they're not racist, but still they think they're somehow superior to the rest of the world, and they want to bring them feminism, all the other liberal values, gay rights, transgender rights, all that stuff. And countries that don't accept it should be forced to accept it. And I think it's the same with Russia today. Because you can notice here in Germany, with the establishment, there's always like this sort of undertone when you read an article that somehow Russians are not fully civilized or on the same level of development as Western Europeans. There's clearly the subtext. And it is always argued that Russians are somehow, the average Russian is somehow captive by some sort of elite, and they also need to be liberated.
You're talking about Europeans that are captured by this ideology. It's a very interesting form of projection. Let me go back to Nikolai here. Is Russia and the West just forever, dyed in the wool enemies? We'll never have any kind of meeting of minds? Because, what I see in the mainstream and Western politicians, it is, they're regurgitating so many of the memes that we've heard in the 20th century.
We've had wise statesmen on both sides, but since we're focusing for a moment on Germany, we have the example of Bismarck, who pursued wise long-term strategies of, I would say, mutual respect with Russia, and tried to encourage his neighbors to do the same. We have in literature a number of authors in Germany who have had warm feelings toward Russia, and expected a long-term mutual understanding to flourish from that, including the poet Rainer Rilke and, for example, Walter Schubach, the philosopher. So I think there is the foundation for a better relationship. But I would stress that the political elite in Germany is divorced from the desires of the populist and from its own historical tradition, at least this aspect of that historical tradition.
When we look at what comes out of the European elites about Russia here, it's state-sponsored Russophobia. The more you examine it, the more it's just kind of irrational, an irrational fear. But I think the real fear is that they know that their own project is failing, and they have to project that failure onto someone else. It's Russia's fault that we have high energy prices. It's Russia's fault their immigration. They do that all of the time. There's no factual basis for it. I mean, they've caused their own problems, or, like, you know, election interference. You know, the European Union interferes in European elections all the time, openly. Okay,
you know, Romania.
Romania is a really good one here. Moldova is another one. I mean, we go on and on and on here. This is much more of a projection. It's more of a tool to keep them, to safeguard their ideology and their political position.
Exactly. But this dehumanization of Russians has a very particular goal. They are behaving like a gambler that lost everything and wants to have one last swing to put all the money in and see if he can win against the house. And this is very dangerous for Europeans. There's a very interesting piece of information that just came out, I don't know, days ago, about the Americans withdrawing 5,000 troops from Germany. And it seems to me this is only the beginning. The Americans, at least this administration, in my view, doesn't want to get caught up in this adventure that the European Union is entering. And that says volumes. I think that we should continue monitoring what is happening in this respect, because it seems to me that although Europeans are not really maybe happy or enthusiastic about the war in the Middle East, they are still completely on board and getting ready to be even more committed to a war against Russia. And the current administration in Washington, in my view, is completely against it. It doesn't want to be a part of it because it knows it will end up with a catastrophe.
You know, Constantine, you know, I'm a keen observer of what's going on with the proxy war in Ukraine, as all of you are here. You know what I find really remarkable, thinking about the commemoration of the end of the war in Europe, is that there's no one in Europe, in power at least, that wants to have negotiations and diplomacy. It's simply not on the agenda. How has that happened?
Well, I think they simply don't want to admit their own defeat. And they think that if they have to negotiate, the public will finally see the emperor without his clothes. And this is why they want to prolong the war as much as possible. And I think the West, including the United States and Western Europe, sees Russia as basically one of its main civilizational rivals. And all the propaganda that the West uses about quote-unquote regimes, like the Putin regime, the Mullah regime in Iran. I mean, the word regime in itself is a propaganda term, because the media, they never say, like, the Putin government or the Russian government. It's always a regime. It's the same with Iran. I mean, they're already, in the eyes of the public, is supposed to delegitimize, like, the ideological and geopolitical enemy. And I think the West views Russia as a geopolitical and ideological enemy. And it has done so for decades and decades. I mean, even centuries, I would argue. So it is just a continuation of what happened in World War II, just to, a lesser degree. But I think the spirit is still very much alive that animated the Nazi aggression against Russia in the past.
Yeah, I think another thing they don't want to really admit that is that Russian civilization, as it stands at this present moment, is a conservative civilization that has succeeded, and that is something they cannot tolerate. Constantine, last 20 seconds to you.
Well, I absolutely agree, because nowadays in the multipolar battle that we're witnessing, it is the liberal hegemon against traditionalist civilization states that are now rising and asserting their sovereignty. And I think the hegemon is about to go down.
Yes, I see everybody nodding here, okay? We ended up on a good note here. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Belgrade, and in Germany. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.